This is not going to be extraordinary, but simple-minded, as you will see in a moment. Thank you, Megan, anyway. When I last taught the Modern American Survey, the first assignment was Fitzgerald's story, Absolution. The last item on the syllabus was Joan Didion's White Album. I found the first of these, of course, in Arthur Meisner's Fitzgerald Reader. This useful collection allows one to teach Fitzgerald as something better than the putative author of The Great Gatsby, or for those who can stand that novel, Tender is the Night. He can become instead what our literary history has agreed to suppose him, the tragic hero of the modern American imagination. This is certainly the figure which Meisner, putting together his selection, has consented to demonstrate. This is the fate, therefore, which a teacher who chooses this text is bound to rehearse. An absolution will in fact serve very well as an introduction to the story one wants to tell. It makes a good beginning for that first messy week of the term. Didion's White Album makes a similarly satisfactory conclusion for a course which is supposed to bring the sequence of canonical instances down into our present. For this book, I will abruptly risk asserting, is the latest indubitable addition to the American canon. One needs something really good to put at the end of any syllabus, where our weakest choices are otherwise apt to accumulate, if only because we have too much choice there, as we do not at the beginning. And the presence of Didion's book in my version of the course had the additional virtue of creating a rhetorical inclusio for me, if not for the students, for she has clearly learned much from Fitzgerald, whom she may indeed have read in a survey course herself once upon a time. She has even, I think, the same subject matter, though she reports it in the negative as a critic rather than in the positive as a novelist, and so as a species of journalism instead of in fiction. Both likeness and difference can seem typical, I think, of the change from what we call modern, meaning the work done between the wars, and what we call contemporary, meaning the vaguer ongoingness since 1945. Between them, the Fitzgerald story and the volume by Didion can accordingly frame what the intervening bulk of our literature has been up to what end it may be said to have been composed, and how we might therefore read it. This is a large claim. Let me begin to substantiate it by reverting to my first instance in more detail. Absolution reads like an early Fitzgerald story, if only because it deals with the shameful yearnings of a young boy still caught in the toils of small-town Middle Western Catholicism. In fact, it was written in June of 1923 in Great Neck and published in Mencken's American Mercury. For a while, Fitzgerald considered using it as the first chapter of Gatsby. It is really prime Fitzgerald then, and well worth receiving, therefore, as exemplary of his central project. At the climax of the story, it may be recalled, the boy Rudolph has come to the priest to confess his sin of lying about lying in the confessional. But Father Schwartz is himself in the throes of a breakdown. He shares with his young penitent the same guilty impulse towards a more desirable life somewhere on the far side of provincial self-deprivation. For Rudolph, the desirable is embodied in a picture of German cuirassiers at Sedan, with its evocation of dawn and breastplate, the crunch of leather and the shine of silver spurs. For the priest, the same ideal appears in the image of an amusement park seen from a distance, hanging out there in the night like a colored balloon to the music of a band and the smell of peanuts. For the narrator, a degree more knowing than either of these two innocents, it is the thought of young girls and young men lying out in the wheat fields under the moon. For both characters, and for Fitzgerald and his anticipated reader, then, the failure of the priest to remember an orthodox answer to these romantic dreams is sufficient proof that there was something ineffably gorgeous somewhere that had nothing to do with God. This deliverance is clearly the master sentence in the story. It affirms what all concerned are meant to realize they had better believe. The proposition sums up the Fitzgerald Project, as he very well knew when he wrote it. For it is, I think, not just easy, but proper, to read the other pieces assembled in the Meisner anthology, or the whole books excerpted there, as well as all the other ancillary texts turned up since by the Fitzgerald industry, as demonstrations of just this faith. What else was Fitzgerald ever able to witness to but the conviction that somewhere, somehow, there must be something gorgeous that had nothing to do with God? The novels and stories become occasions for the display of various persons, blessed or cursed, with some vision of the desirable in just this absolute sense. Gatsby, the type of them all, locates the essential gorgeousness in Daisy, but everyone in the Fitzgerald universe is afflicted with the same longing. Mrs. Wilson, for instance, locates the object of it in the puppies sold on the sidewalk by the man who resembles John D. Rockefeller. Such comic examples distance us from the absurd or vulgar variants of the general case, as irony and sorrow inform our ambivalent intimacy with the solemn instances. No one escapes, least of all that virtually fictional personage, F. Scott himself. To be sure, his faith in the imagined object of desire modulates from obsession through enchantment to bemusement and on as far as disillusion, as we read from tale to tale through the work of a rapid lifetime. But the basic kerygma itself remains constant. There is no other truth to be revealed. So disillusion must be followed not by any radical change of heart. And would we really like Fitzgerald to have become a Marxist? But by the emergence of some new illusion to replace the old. A daughter, to mention one dangerous instance, can take the place of her mother in the affections of a husband and father. But this is no change in kind. All manifestations of the desirable are in principle the same to Fitzgerald, as indeed they have got to be for anyone. To lose one's desire for the desirable is then to lose one's life, for life is simply the ever-reviving hope that somehow, somewhere, the gorgeous will appear again, to be pursued, drunk, bought, kissed, remembered, and in any case imagined in words, for it is not, after all, quite ineffable. So far, I am sure, I have been describing the Fitzgerald we all know well. One can add to this another familiar truth, that Fitzgerald's stories, whether fictional or autobiographical or both, are magically successful in converting the reader to his faith, at least imaginatively, which might seem all that was required, if indeed the faith recommended is precisely in that which can be imagined. The gorgeousness is made as evident to us as it is to the fictional personage whose story we are reading. This is the seductive power of those passages in which Gatsby kisses Daisy on the sidewalk in Louisville, or Nick gazes across the Sound at the little green light, or Rosemary catches a glimpse of Nicole's face. These patches vary from the purplest excesses of what, in a spasm of resistance, we may call bad writing, the literary equivalent of vulgarity or drunkenness, to those beautifully dexterous invocations of casual glamour, which bring us to consent without a murmur, as when we hear Daisy say, "Do you always watch for the longest day of the year and then miss it? I always watch for the longest day of the year and then miss it," and fall in love with her ourselves, then and there. But all, good or bad, demonstrate the gospel they are preaching. Fitzgerald believes in the objects of the imagination, so he exerts his own to make us exert ours. The imagined becomes imaginable indeed. It is still merely imaginary, to be sure. He admits this himself. But as long as the enchantment lasts, it is as true, he believes, as anything in the world can be. It is all there is to believe. This observation may be generalized. It is, I think, most typical of modern American literature that the works we value present whatever it is they recommend to our belief in the positive. The various alternatives to God are made explicit in the texts which testify to the possibility in question. Imagination is faith. Hemingway, the other obvious name, can provide another illustration of the same principle. Some here will recall how the New Yorker began an issue last spring with a story by an unnamed writer about an experience of his in our contemporary Middle West, where he confessed he had been abruptly overtaken by a wish to read the opening sentence of A Farewell to Arms. He went into the public library of the small town in which he found himself to locate a copy of this book, only to learn that it had been banned. The rest of the anecdote had to do with the issue thus exposed. There are still those who would protect our Rudolph's innocence by starving their imaginations. But I was most impressed, reading this anecdote, by its author's account of his initial predicament. For I, too, had a special feeling about the first chapter of A Farewell to Arms, and it must have been the whole chapter this writer was thinking of, not just the first sentence, good as that is. My father, a member of the same literary generation with Fitzgerald and Hemingway, had once in my boyhood read this chapter aloud to me as an introduction to the literary life, and in particular to the sort of thing which someone he had once known well could do when he set his mind to it. So the casual but accurate allusion in The New Yorker, the placing of which presumed that one man's piety would naturally be shared by a fair proportion of our current upper middle class, showed me that my own associations with the passage were not just a private memory, but part of our literary history generally, like the words themselves. The story, its context, and my response seemed a composite sign that the Hemingway passage and the book it introduces, and so the rest of Hemingway's achievement, still counted for something in America, which was why it might be at once possible and wrong to take this book off the shelves of a public library in a small town, and equivalently right to go on teaching him in the survey course, right too even for me to have chosen A Farewell to Arms instead of The Sun Also Rises, the more conventional, but perhaps after all no longer the best choice for the purpose. At the center of this small glow of happy feeling was, of course, what occurs in the passage. That first chapter of A Farewell to Arms is memorable because it displays what Hemingway believed could be believed in when it seemed there was nothing left to believe in, the post-war or modern situation in a formula. But what he feels credible is not the imagination as such, but the senses. We can believe, this chapter tells us, in such things as the pebbles and boulders, dry and white in the sun, and in the dust powdered on the trees and the leafy branches laid on the tractors that pulled the guns. The paratactic order is a syntactic reflection of Hemingway's regard for individual moments of sensation. Especially are we offered a chance to realize the troops marching past in the rain with the two leather cartridge boxes on the front of the belts, gray leather boxes heavy with the packs of clips of thin, long 6.5-millimeter cartridges bulged forward under the capes so that the men passing on the road marched as though they were 6 months gone with child. The New Yorker writer did not quote this sentence, but of course he knew it was there. And no doubt he, like others here, would be able to explain why even remembering this sentence, much less reading it aloud, can sometimes make tears start to the eyes. It goes on, that is one reason, continuing through smaller and smaller units of perception, each of which can be realized anew through our commonest understanding of weight, slenderness, dampness, exhaustion, and the fatal difference between equipment and flesh, death and life, men and women. But in precisely this linked sequence is embodied Hemingway's faith. in the power of sensations no grander than these, to reply even to the pointlessness of war. Like Fitzgerald, Hemingway offers positive instances of what there is, according to him, to believe in. And we are grateful accordingly, for we would all of us like to know. I have said that the same positivity may be observed in the work of other writers of the first modern generation. It seems to distinguish them from the immediately preceding group who reached adulthood before the First War. A Sinclair Lewis, for instance, could show that the Philistine circumstances of American life should not be believed in, but could not make the dreams of his characters seem any better than pathetic. A Lewis novel has to be satiric. But a William Carlos Williams poem has indeed found a way to enact that trust in the motions of experience on behalf of which the poet is testifying. His meter is his argument. Similarly, though in so very different a style, the last stanza of Sunday Morning is memorable because its image of birds descending and the deliquescent sounds through which that image is presented, combined with the elegant periodicity of the syntax, to display precisely that beauty of which, as the poet affirms, the mother is death. Williams and Stevens now seem the major poetic voices of the period, if we discount Eliot. The other standard prose writer is Faulkner, who, it turns out, believes in manhood. It's interesting that people laugh when that word is used. He cannot show this quality prevailing in the present, but it dominates his presentation of the past, and in Faulkner's world, we know well, the past dominates the present. Manhood has to be believed in precisely in proportion to its implausibility. The one significant exception to the rule would indeed seem to be Eliot, whose special project is evidently the dramatization of a state of affairs in which there is indeed nothing to believe in. But Eliot is not really quite that exceptional, except in clarity of mind. His poems maintain a steady awareness of what for other writers of the time is apt to remain a marginal doubt. He knows what the various modern alternatives are alternatives to. He knows that imagination or sensation or subjectivity or culture, high or low, are as objects of belief no better than substitutes for God. And his poems demonstrate the implausibility of all these surrogates. If it is impossible to believe in God, it is still more impossible, according to him, to believe in anything else. By the end of The Wasteland, this conviction has become almost a challenge. Let God say a true word, so we need not waste time repeating ourselves, who are not true, and shoring up fragments of inherited fiction against our ruins. And in the later work, which commences at just this point, God does in fact reappear as at least a possible object of belief for somebody somewhere. But God never does appear in the poems. That would be reasonable only for a prophet, which Eliot knows he is not. So we are left with certain modest observations in prose and verse by a man who had come to believe in God after all, while continuing to know better than ever that nothing else deserved belief, including himself. Though unfortunately the English-speaking world decided for a while to believe in him. His poetry then, like his drama, is really a species of criticism, which incidentally makes him a rare anticipation of our postmodern or contemporary period, though paradoxically the decline in his reputation prevents us from appreciating precisely the contribution he might now make. Thinking of Eliot can prompt a still higher level of generalization. The Wasteland, after all, is a concentrated demonstration of a very sweeping judgment indeed. And in his prose criticism, Eliot did not restrain himself from others of a similar scope. His example might accordingly encourage us to understand the modern period as a whole, in American literature as elsewhere, as one more instance of an intention which has seemed to prevail in Western culture since the Renaissance at least. Secularism, the note which most broadly defines modernity in every context, has had a different character in the West from its apparent equivalents in antiquity or the Orient. It does not mean simply the natural or profane, that which is left over, as it were, once the sacred is abandoned or bracketed or simply left to its own devices. We have never been able to exist merely as the flesh in the absence of the spirit, though some have wished we could. Instead, the flesh has insisted upon the very privileges of that spirit it began by losing faith in. Man has asserted the right to do for and as himself what God had apparently failed to do for him. This ambition to assume the attributes of a God in whom we could not believe accounts, I suspect, for the uncanny dynamism that has empowered Western civilization. Our nations have triumphed as alternatives to the church. Science has made knowledge a substitute for inspiration and faith alike. Our wars approximate totality because they conceal an apocalyptic intention. The natural, as Mike Abrams has pointed out, has become the supernatural in one context after another. And so on. One needn't belabor the point through an indefinite number of examples. The common note for them all is the ambition of the flesh to become not just what is left over after the spirit has departed, but a revolutionary replacement for or parody of that same spirit as it had once claimed to be. Modernity is a reaction not just to denial, but disappointment. We must make our own kingdom because God has failed to establish his. Against this background, one can appreciate anew the special function of the arts. It would not take a Nietzsche to inform us that if God is dead, the gods will revive. But if ours must be a feral rather than original paganism, the principalities and powers that solicit allegiance would have to be rediscovered all over again. It then becomes the special task of the arts to exhibit these credenda as they manifest themselves here and now. Science excludes belief except in the kind of knowledge which can do without it. Philosophy has notoriously made itself the handmaid of science. Politics may rely on force or fraud, but the arts, as the West has practiced them since they were disentangled from courtly play or popular craft, have necessarily been concerned with the credible. And among the arts, literature must be ranked as first among equals. The other arts are mute, said Northrop Frye some time ago. But literature can articulate its gospels, however indirectly. Our stories, then, are parables, our poems embodiments of what there is to believe in, according to whoever comes forward to testify. By these means, we seek to learn where we are and what we are free to do. From such all but overfamiliar generalizations, let me descend once again to the particulars of literary history. If the modern period, at least in our American case, can virtually be defined in terms of the positives therein proposed as alternatives for belief, what should we make, in the light of just such a proposal, of the far messier time that has so indistinctly supervened, the postmodern or contemporary era of our letters? Our more recent writers have often seen themselves as coming after their predecessors as a second generation, like the Victorians after the Romantics, or the poets of the later 18th century after the Augustans. They have felt themselves belated in exactly Harold Bloom's sense, whose celebrated formula may indeed be read as an interpretation of just this predicament. They have accordingly been disposed either to continue so much of the original project as might still seem unfinished, the great American novel still unwritten, the revolution in poetry stalled for so many years, or to demonstrate that, after all, certain modern proposals had themselves become implausible with the passage of time. Both impulses may be traced confusedly through our recent period. If the second is not only the more up-to-date, but a more thorough resolution of the initial ambivalence, we could now repeat in another tone a judgment that used to be passed around in those first post-war years, to the effect that the genius of the age seemed better adapted to criticism than creation. The special achievement of our time could then be specified as an emerging discovery that certain substitutes for God would not in fact do the job. Communism and the poem itself, two earlier idols, have been successively revealed as incredible. Realism, humanism, and the avant-garde have almost followed. Postmodernism in every context is then an atheism to the second degree. One could admit that the American literature of the earlier period might be almost too moving in proportion to its comparative innocence. In proposing alternate objects for belief, it was, after all, still carrying out a variant of the initial romantic or transcendentalist project. It had not yet caught up with the more radical skepticism of the great Europeans. But by the close of the Second War, one could say, American culture had begun to take in the full import of a wearier modernity, which had from the start included as a critical as well as a positive disposition. The difficulty, of course, has been to maintain the integrity of this new sense of the negative in the face of a continually renewed need among the young to go on believing in something. Americans do not like believing that there is in truth nothing whatsoever to believe in. But if there is nothing to believe in, nihilism is only common sense. Which brings me a step nearer Joan Didion, whom you will have thought I had forgotten long ago. Not so. I shall in a moment advance her claim to represent just this critical process. But before opening the White Album, we should take notice of some intervening instances between the earlier testimony and its gradual interrogation by just such an unbelief as I shall presently be honoring in her book. Let me begin this final parenthesis, then, with an example of the halfway stage just mentioned, in which it might still seem one's task to carry out the modern project in whatever way apparently remained incomplete. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man persists on our reading lists as a major representative of this intermediate posture, not just thematically, but formally. There it still is, a great American novel indeed, with the inevitable male protagonist trying to create himself in a world he did not make. Its issue is also familiar, to discover yet once more what on earth could be believed in, so as to form an identity upon it. The protagonist's first and last word is, "I am invisible," by which he means, "I am not the man you are looking at." But though Ellison's character is not what they, white or black, suppose him to be, he never does become able to say in so many words who he is instead. This unnamed hero remains underground still at the end of the story. It is symptomatic of the problem addressed that Ellison himself should have proved unable to complete a second novel in all the years since. The formal reflection of this persistent blank is the absence of a narrative voice other than another solemn version of the novelistic prose of the period, which is to say an idiom of the white world. There is no black voice in this book, as black critics have noticed, though without, of course, being able to supply the deficiency themselves. There is no story beyond the ending and no voice beginning with the beginning. At the heart of this big book, obsessed with the problem of identity, is a continuing absence of exactly that. It is not difficult, I think, to identify identity as the chief focus for possible belief throughout the contemporary period. It has been, it seems to me, especially an obsession of my generation. The social thinkers in vogue can illustrate at large, from David Riesman and Eric Erickson to Christopher Lasch. Even the professional Americanists have got into the act, locating the American Adam in one or another figure from the remoter past. The academic mind is apt to rediscover in some alien context whatever is most acutely missing in its own. So we have peopled the library with instances of the self we did not have, affirming identity as style, when in fact all we were doing was rereading old books. Of course, the more interesting instances have had to be as responsive to the negative as well as the positive side of the question. Herzog is probably the best novel of the first phase of our period. We could even say that the 50s ended in 1964 with the publication of what has remained Bellow's principal book, as we could say that the 60s started in 1956 with the first reading of Howell. If Invisible Man ends with a hero whose life has yet to begin, Herzog begins with someone for whom it is already too late. He knows as well as his author that his identity is incredible, but what else is new? The rest of the world is worse off still, for they do not yet know at least that much. He is left with a gift of the gab. This is almost enough to get by on. No one need suppose it confers existence, to admit as much as indeed the wisdom of this novel as of others like it. A more self-consciously sophisticated variant of Herzog's letter-writing strategy makes the process of composition itself the focus of whatever identity may be claimed. Alfred Kazin's Walker in the City, for instance, might stand for this possibility. Autobiography will always make one at least whoever one becomes in the act of writing. But to believe in this literary truism is absurd. One becomes fictional oneself in proportion. And so no one, really, after all. The extreme of such a fate is the figure who has become only what others write of him or her. As Norman Mailer is now saying, I am interviewed, therefore I must still be. The poets have been more hospitable to the destructive element in the identity project than the novelists.